As has been shown in the previous chapters, the eye's experience of life is determined by a general organ for each basic energy that is rooted in the superconsciousness. As each basic energy forms a certain specific plane of existence, the six general organs of the eye will thus be identical with one body for each plane of existence. The experience of life on each plane of existence can thus take place directly only through the existing body for that particular plane of existence. As these bodies in turn are created realities consisting of substance, matter or energy that can be subject to the influence of stronger energies, and receive injuries, and become obsolete and worn out, the experience of life will form itself perfectly or imperfectly according to whether these bodies are perfect or imperfect. And as these bodies, just like all other created things, ultimately become unfit for use and must therefore be replaced by new ones, the eye's experience of life in every single plane of existence is thus interrupted from the moment the old body for the relevant plane is separated from the eye until the moment when the birth of the new body for the same plane takes place. So when the old body is separated from the eye, the latter cannot sense directly on the relevant plane of existence and will therefore be more or less unconscious on this plane as long as the construction of the new body is still not completed. As this process of renewal is in principle identical for all six bodies of manifestation, the eye or the living being thus experiences six different repeated interruptions in its total experience of life. Now, according to eternal laws, these interruptions do not occur simultaneously but in such a way that only one body at a time is totally subject to renewal. The individual will therefore also, for as long as such a process of renewal is taking place, experience life through the other five bodies of manifestation in the eternal body. The individual's experience of life as a whole can thus never be totally interrupted. The interruptions can span only one single plane of existence at a time. Chapter 24, The Terrestrial Human Being's Realization of Cosmic Consciousness. As the physical body of the terrestrial human being constitutes the one of his six bodies of manifestation that is the most developed, it therefore being able to correspond to the greatest extent with physical energy, while the other bodies in relation to this are more or less latent, the physical plane of existence becomes the plane on which the same being is most conscious, and the other planes, that is, the spiritual, become those on which he is least conscious. Indeed, the spiritual consciousness of the terrestrial human being is sometimes so small in relation to the physical consciousness of this being that he even believes only the latter exists and that all spiritual or cosmic consciousness is imagination or superstition. Later in evolution, when the individual reaches the last planes of existence in a spiral zone, the situation is reversed. Then it is the spiritual planes of existence of which he is most conscious, and his physical perception that is latent. The physical world is thus temporarily the most real for terrestrial mankind, which therefore also believes to a great extent that the latter world is the only reality, just as the same is of course also the case with regard to the perception of physical bodies of the individuals. Chapter 25, The Fear of Death is Due to Ignorance. As the senses of the ordinary terrestrial human being are not yet sufficiently strong to enable him to acquire the analysis of his eye through his own experience, and as he, as a consequence of this, is cut off from being conscious of his immortality, all spiritual existence for this being is still only a matter of belief or a theory. It is therefore inevitable that his conceptions and ideas about life stand or fall with his physical body. As there will come a day when his physical body will be worn out and its interaction with the other bodies can therefore no longer be maintained, it will, as already stated, be separated from the eye and become visible as a corpse. As the individual believes himself to be one with the said body, he does not look forward to this event with joy but rather very much with fear. Indeed, this fear can sometimes even develop into raging terror. He does not understand the situation and believes that the process of death is the incontestable end of him, his total annihilation. As the terrestrial human being thus believes that this process or death is an annihilation of the individual or a complete end to his existence, it is not only his own meeting with this process that he anticipates with terror but also, of course, the contact his loved ones will have with this process. So when this process strikes one of these loved ones, the survivor mourns and clothes himself in sorrow. Indeed, it would be absolutely in contravention of the prevailing moral code if he or she did not mourn. Chapter 26, Natural Death as an Event of Light. When death occurs in a natural way, it is, in reality, an event of light about which there is every possible reason to rejoice. All that has happened is that the so-called dead person has been freed from an obsolete or outworn body that was only a shadow of what it had once been, and through which his experience of the plane of existence in question could likewise be, of course, only a reflection of its original purpose. Indeed, sometimes even only an experience of 20-25% instead of 100%. To mourn such an event, to wish that some being should continue experiencing such an existence, is of course in reality to wish evil upon that being, but this must of course be excused because the beings concerned do not know what has actually happened. They have of course no self-experienced or realistic knowledge of the fact that the dead being has five other bodies at his disposal, and that one of these at the time of natural death will always be so far advanced that it will be able to promote or sustain the consciousness after death. Chapter 27, Unnatural Death. In cases of unnatural death, things are somewhat different. By unnatural death must here be understood all kinds of death that are not caused by old age. And it cannot be denied that a very large percentage of terrestrial mankind's individuals are still so far in evolution from knowing, and thereby fulfilling, the eternal laws on which the experience of life is based that a shortened physical lifetime must inevitably be the result. As a shortened lifetime is an abnormality, it will, just like all other unnatural or abnormal phenomena, involve a certain unpleasantness. But this unpleasantness will be the less the more spiritually developed the being is, and the greater the less spiritually developed the being is. The basic cause of this unpleasantness is precisely this, that in the case of a premature death, the spiritual body that should sustain the consciousness of the individual after death has not had time to develop the necessary strength and stability for the purpose. Through a premature death or separation of the physical body, the day consciousness is suddenly transferred to the aforesaid spiritual body. As this body is not yet fully mature for this mission, it will in a way be overburdened, which in turn, in the worst cases, can result in abnormal mental states in the first sphere of the spiritual plane of existence. In cases where death is the result of a prolonged prior illness, the maturing of this spiritual body is somewhat precipitated, and the unpleasantness of this premature death will thus be correspondingly less. Chapter 28, Suicides and Death. For the individual who commits suicide, the unpleasantness is further increased by the dreadful disappointment that death is not, as he had believed, a deliverance from his difficulties, but that he, on the contrary, in addition to being still fully conscious of them, has now also inflicted upon himself the suffering that he will, to a certain extent, have to endure an abnormal spiritual existence, with the prospect of a repetition of these difficulties in his next physical life on earth. He thus witnesses the fact that he cannot run away from his fate. Had he put up with those difficulties until death had occurred of its own accord, his spiritual existence would at least have been more normal and strengthening for his next terrestrial life. Chapter 29, Purgatory. But as all beings, in order to be born in a new physical body, must pass through all the highest kingdoms of the spiral, even if of course in rather elementary or latent forms, the unpleasantness will stretch only as far as the first kingdom after death, and, at that, only as far as its very lowest sphere. This sphere is known on the physical plane as purgatory, and has furthermore through superstition been called hell. There will thus be a certain unpleasant zone for all beings with imperfections to pass through after physical death. But the eternal fire or everlasting damnation with which the primitive imagination has equipped it certainly does not exist. It can still be very unpleasant, but as the unpleasantness can exist only as effects of the individual's own mistakes, and as the unpleasantness in turn, as a supplement to physical existence, has as its mission the stimulating of the individual not to make mistakes, not to commit suicide again, not to live unnaturally. In other words, it is the guide to a perfect life or the direction towards God, and as it furthermore in the form of unpleasantness spans only a very limited sphere in relation to the whole spiritual zone, which otherwise constitutes an ocean of light and bliss, it is in its most profound analysis a divine blessing. There will therefore in reality be no justifiable basis whatsoever for mourning the unnatural death or departure to another world of friends or relatives. If the deceased has children or other relatives who will suffer from this death, it falls to the relatives and friends of the survivors together with society to take the place of the deceased and meet their needs. The dead person will thereby be brought more easily through the zone of unpleasantness, for he or she in this very zone can, up to a certain point, keep in contact with the physical plane, and so be relieved of the burden that the sight of the need and misery of those left behind, the sight of their tears, privation and despair, would be for him or her. To mourn over the death or transference to the spiritual world of beings is a primitive manifestation of consciousness and is thus maintained by ignorance of, or unacquaintedness with, the true facts. One thus gladdens and supports the dead by not mourning. Good, friendly thoughts directed towards the dead and a true love for those they have left behind constitute the absolutely highest or most divine epitaph that can possibly be given to any individual. Chapter 30, Death as Resurrection. As already mentioned, sorrow and the fear of death or dying are quite unfounded. Besides the physical body that the individual loses at death, he has five other bodies. From this point life goes on towards even more perfect planes of existence in the spiritual regions while the spiritual preparation for the creation of a new physical body is in process. When the creation of the embryo of the new physical body is complete and it has thereby become mature enough to begin sustaining the consciousness, birth occurs and the individual again begins to become conscious on the physical plane. And the I, incarnated in the new physical body, finds itself once again able to communicate in the physical world. But instead of the old, worn-out body that it left at the time of its physical death, it now finds itself, insofar as its death and spiritual existence have been normal, in a new, glorified body dedicated to youth and beauty, to love and passion, to life and work. As death, just like birth, cannot exist without meaning the entrance to new life, it will, under all circumstances, be identical with resurrection or the realistic manifestation that expresses the I's all-outshining radiant power over material, its mastery of life and the rendering visible of its eternal, elevated or divine imperishability. Chapter 31, Terrestrial Disharmony Gives Rise to Spiritual Development. The eternal existence of the terrestrial human being thus takes the form of alternating physical and spiritual existences. As this being in its evolution still finds itself in the second plane of existence of the spiral zone, that is, the physical world, its physical body will, as previously mentioned, be the most developed, while the bodies for the other planes in the same spiral cycle, on the other hand, are still relatively unfinished or latent. The physical existences therefore also become the most fundamental for the same individual. But gradually, as evolution proceeds, the individual becomes more and more spiritually developed. Since the physical body, as far as the terrestrial human being is concerned, has passed its evolutionary peak, it will therefore be the spiritual bodies of the same being that are under development. In this growth, the body of feeling, the seat for the individual's faculty to sense or experience pleasantness or unpleasantness, will thus be that which is most advanced. Next comes the body of intelligence, the seat for the individual's faculty to define the experiences of pleasantness and unpleasantness or to create knowledge from these experiences. The evolution of terrestrial mankind will thus primarily be based upon the development of feeling and intelligence. As feeling can only be developed through suffering, and intelligence through competition in the struggle for one's daily bread, the earth is extremely well designed for such development, because its citizens, grounded in their primitive or relatively latent level of feeling, do not hesitate to maintain their existence, their pleasure or well-being at the expense of the overexertion, poverty, sickness, pain, need and even mutilation of their fellow beings or, in brief, entirely upon the right of these beings to life. In a world where the instinct for self-preservation of the beings is mutually or reciprocally based on such a level of feeling, only the strongest and the most insensitive or inconsiderate will, without outside assistance, be able to reach a high physical position, meaning wealth and material prestige, while the less greedy or more sensitive or considerate must of necessity become the vanquished and so the slaves of the victor. The earth is therefore also the scene of many tears, much want and suffering, chaos, need and misery. It is the battlefield for the struggle of the beings for booty. But as such conditions or difficulties inevitably give rise to a growing desire in mankind for ordered relations or harmony, which in turn can exist only as identical with spiritual development, such a form of development can thus be traced in the terrestrial zone. But in order to attain ordered relations in the world, knowledge is essential. The desire referred to then also manifests itself to a great extent as an attraction towards all enlightenment about the eternal facts or most profound causes of life. The most universally known and most realistic result of this development is, as previously mentioned, science. Chapter 32, Science Becomes the Salvation of the World. Science, when it has developed the maturity necessary in all areas, spiritual as well as physical, to prove that any egoistic act whatsoever is a hindrance to the creation of the perfect society, will become the salvation of the world. Only absolute knowledge of the eternal facts can put its source in a position to control matter, and thereby might, for the benefit of right. But as knowledge cannot be absolute or perfect by means of intelligence alone but, on the contrary, only by being identical with the balanced result of experiences of intelligence and feeling, and as this result is the same as love, any kind of knowledge can be absolute only when it is a science of love. This knowledge then becomes manifest to everyone as constituting the Holy Spirit. For the time being it still constitutes in the zone of the earth merely the unborn embryo of this, its identity. Chapter 33, Science is already to a certain degree illuminating the world. As a science, in order to be absolute or genuine, must be identical with the analysis of a fact, that part of terrestrial science that is an expression of the absolute facts will thus be the first fundamental or realistic realization of the truth or the eternal facts, but of course as yet only the physical side or appearance of these factors. Before I go further into science, the following quotation from Leavitt's Bog section 180, which shows that terrestrial science, even in its embryo stage, is extremely illuminating, can perhaps be justified. It reads, as science constitutes the first beginnings of knowledge of the universe and existence, it thus forms the periphery of the cosmic or spiritual world. It is the dawning cosmic consciousness. It is the fresh sea air by the sea. Modern science will thus in reality be unshakable proof of the fact that terrestrial mankind is becoming spiritual. Remove science from its consciousness, and all that remains is a primitive animal consciousness receptive only to coarse influences. Mankind would consist solely of beings who could not possibly perceive the clear light of a written book, who could not possibly perceive what an ingenious work of art is saying, who could not possibly harness the material forces in engines or other kinds of machines or means of transport over land and sea, through the clouds and under the water. Beings who could not create buildings, clothes and articles for everyday use, indeed, beings who could not even express themselves through a perfect language. Through the achievements of science, the faint ticking of a clock can be heard from pole to pole and all the peoples of the earth can listen to the same lecture at the same time. By means of microscopes and telescopes the terrestrial human being has extended his material sight hundreds of times into the microcosmic as well as the macrocosmic world. From universities, schools and colleges the cosmic light in the form of science radiates out over the whole world. It rests like newly fallen snow in everything, on everything and over everything. Science is thus the first fundamental result of the penetration of a higher spiritual energy into the energy of gravity or the physical world. Chapter 34, Science and the Holy Spirit. As already stated, science is identical with the penetration of a higher energy into the physical plane. This higher energy constitutes the fourth basic energy, the energy of intelligence, and forms the basis for the human being's ability to define and thereby realize the analyses of his experiences of pleasantness and unpleasantness or his sensation of feelings. In other words, the above-mentioned energy forms the basis for what we call the intellect. Science thus represents the collective intellect of mankind. But, since the energy of intelligence, as previously stated, is the fourth basic energy in the spiral zone, and since the terrestrial human being in evolution is primarily still situated in the culmination zone of only the second basic energy, it will be understood that the energy of intelligence to a great extent will still be considered as relatively latent in this being. The collective intellect of terrestrial mankind will thus, despite all the light that, as previously mentioned, in the form of science has spread out over the world, be considered primitive compared to what it one day will be. But this is also consistent with its identity as the unborn embryo of the Holy Spirit. The faculty of knowledge or the intellect is thus in reality still not the most pronounced factor of consciousness in the terrestrial human being. There will therefore be other characteristics that are of an older date in this being and that therefore to a corresponding degree are more pronounced than the intelligence. These other characteristics consist to a particularly high degree of faculties that are promoted by the second and third basic energies of the spiral zone, which in Levitz-Bogue are respectively expressed as the energy of gravity and the energy of feeling. Chapter 35, The Killing Principle Becomes a Vital Necessity. As the nature of the energy of gravity is explosive and the energy of feeling is the opposite, having a restraining or binding effect on the energy of gravity, a consciousness in which these two energies have supremacy can almost be likened to a volcano. If the energy of feeling preponderates, it will restrain the energy of gravity and prevent explosions, but if the energy of gravity preponderates, it will overcome the restraint of the energy of feeling and explosions will occur. Such explosions in the consciousness are of course in a microscopic or spiritual form but are reflected in the thought life or mental life of the individual as hot temper, rage or bloodthirstiness. Indeed, in brief, they are the deepest provoking factors for every form of urge towards the promoting of the killing principle. And as the energy of gravity has an entire zone, that is, a plane of existence where it cannot be totally bound by the energy of feeling, the I's experience of life on this plane of existence thus cannot take place except on the basis of these explosions. And the previously mentioned factors of consciousness, hot temper, rage and bloodthirstiness, thus here predominate and turn the killing principle into a vital necessity. This zone, where the individuals simply must kill in order to live, will thus be recognized as the animal kingdom or the second plane of existence in the spiral zone to which the terrestrial human being still belongs. By killing must here be understood the destruction of the physical body and not an annihilation of the I, which is, as already shown, immortal. Chapter 36. The individual attains certainty instead of vague notions. The life form or mental condition of the animal kingdom must thus be described as a constant struggle or interaction between two basic energies, of which one is characterized by a tendency to expand and the other by a tendency to contract. Where the latter energy suddenly becomes the lesser of the two, an explosion must of course always follow. I cannot here go into detailed analyses, for they would take up far too much space. I can, however, mention that these explosions in the mental life, from being quite microscopic or absolutely beyond observation by physical sensory perception, spread through the conscious mental life and manifestations of the individual further and further until they finally assume such considerable dimensions that they manifest themselves on the physical plane as identical to, among other things, the most profound causes of war, terror and mutilation. All forms of suffering will thus, when analyzed cosmically, be based on an excess of the energy of gravity and a deficiency of the energy of feeling in the conscious mental life. But, as the same principle that deposits hard skin on a hand doing rough work, in order to protect it, also endows the individual, through repeated explosions or sufferings, with a correspondingly increasing ability to use the energy of feeling, He becomes more and more master of the energy of gravity or the explosions, outbursts of rage or anger. They gradually become less violent, being more and more restrained, and an increasingly calm mental life begins to be manifested. But as individuals at this stage still primarily have only the remains of the first basic energy of the spiral zone, that is the energy of instinct, with which to make themselves conscious in their emotional life. The realization of this emotional life becomes realistic fact only in the form of pleasantness and unpleasantness, not in the form of detailed analyses. By means of the ability to make use of the energy of instinct, which means instinct, the individual cannot define but only sense vaguely. This in turn means that his reasoning cannot become analyzes suitable for the intelligence through instinct and is therefore not practical, absolute knowledge but only suppositions, which again are the same as vague notions. As the energy of instinct has, however, already culminated in the plant kingdom and is thus degenerating, or on the decline, in the animal kingdom, and especially so at its human stage, the vague notions of the individual will to a corresponding degree be untrustworthy or inaccurate. And the individual's realization in the form of instinct or vague sensing will thus be correspondingly inaccurate. As knowledge that is based on vague notions is the same as belief, every kind of belief that is based on inaccurate notions will be the same as superstition. Superstition is thus the same as incorrect understanding of the experience of life or reality. But as superstition is thus a disharmony in existence, the individual's principle of creation, which, as previously mentioned, gave rise to the hard skin for the protection of his hand and in the same way expanded his faculty for feeling as a resistance against the explosions of the energy of gravity, will now also give rise to a hard skin in defense against superstition. This hard skin is the ability to make use of the fourth basic energy of the spiral zone, namely the energy of intelligence. By means of this, the individual gradually becomes able to confirm or disprove the vague notions and thereby comes into possession of the analyses of absolute facts, which is the same as absolute knowledge. Intelligence is thus the same as the ability of the individual to acquire certainty instead of vague notions. Chapter 37, The Basic Cause of the Dark Fate of Terrestrial Man. Within the animal kingdom there is thus an area where the individual begins to come into possession of certainty or real knowledge instead of vague notions. This area is made up mainly of terrestrial human beings. By the appropriation of certainty instead of vague notions, the individual becomes enriched with an exceptionally great new element of consciousness or manifestation. But the individual at first does not have the ability to use this element in harmony with life's eternal laws of existence. This he must learn from experience. But as this element, like all the other great elements in life, can give rise only to harmony, happiness or an ultimate well-being by being used in contact with the law of existence or in tune with the general order of the universe, which means to the advantage of the welfare of people in general, and as individuals at first cannot have such experiences, he must of necessity to a great extent use this, his new element of consciousness or intelligence, wrongly. He uses it primarily for his own self-interest and so becomes to a corresponding degree troublesome to the existence or maintenance of life of his fellow beings. And with this we have arrived at the basic cause of the present collective dark fate of terrestrial mankind. Most of the above-mentioned individuals find themselves precisely at the stage in evolution where they have still not learned to use intelligence for the benefit of the whole of humanity. And as the same humanity consists of single individuals, the whole cannot possibly be an expression of harmony and interplay, perfection and true happiness until the majority of the people on earth have evolved so far that their use of intelligence for the benefit of people in general, instead of to their own advantage, is just as great as what is today an expression of these beings' use of their faculty of intelligence for their egoistic interests. Chapter 38, Society is governed by primitive tendencies of consciousness. The collective intelligence of terrestrial mankind is thus to a great extent still to be summed up as primitive and inferior to the energy of feeling. This means that mankind to a great extent still acts not on real intelligence but on feeling. and as instinct is degenerating and intelligence is still too small or weak to define feeling, it will consequently be undefined.